Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today as we finally, at long last, get to the interview that I did with Jeremy Narby from a few weeks ago. I've been holding on to it at the request of his publicist to coincide the release of this interview with the release of his brand new book. The title is Plant Teachers, Ayahuasca, Tobacco, and the Pursuit of Knowledge. And it's actually co-authored with an Amazonian shaman, Rafael Chanchari Pizuri. We had a great conversation a few weeks ago, talked a long time, spent a lot of time actually talking about Oregon and about other places, but I've edited that out of the beginning of our talk. It was just our get to know you period, but we still have a long conversation for you here on the podcast today. So I hope you enjoy it. We'll be talking all about ayahuasca and tobacco, and also quite significantly, Jeremy's experience of being an anthropologist, studying a different culture, working for a scientific institution, and just kind of juggling all of that and his own interest in psychedelics and also having his own psychedelic experiences. So we get into all of it. It's a great conversation. Really looking forward to bringing that to all of you. Coming up in about 2 weeks from today, after we have another selection from Orbeez Vision, I already have a great interview with Carlos Tanner, who is the director of the Ayahuasca Foundation. So we're going to be keeping on the same theme of ayahuasca for the next couple of weeks. Not sure what interviews I have coming up after that, but I'm sure that they will be fascinating, educational, and entertaining for all of you out there in listener land. Before we get to the conversation with Jeremy, just a couple quick announcements. Would like to thank Brooke for making her monthly contribution in support of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. So every month I get to say Brooke's name here on the podcast. Also would like to thank Ben, who made a generous donation over the past couple of weeks to the podcast. Thank you both very much for your support. This, of course, is a listener-supported podcast. Your donations help pay for the bandwidth and storage of this podcast. Also helps pay for the time that I put into doing the interviews and doing the research and doing the editing and all of that. So if you'd like to support this podcast, it's quite easy. Just stop by my personal webpage, www.martinball.net. There's a PayPal link at the top right of the page, or you can join up as a monthly supporter over at Patreon. As I mentioned, every week I have everything from $1 a month up to $100 a month with increasing benefits, access, and bonuses. As you go along, there's lots of different levels. Find what's comfortable for you and join me over at Patreon. It's a great way to support my work and support this podcast in general. Of course, I am still available for 30, 60, and 90-minute integration consultation calls. If you'd like to arrange that, you can always stop by and check out more at www.nondualentheogenicintegration.com or just shoot me an email at martinwball@gmail.com. We can set up a time to talk about your experiences. Of course, I specialize in 5-MeO-DMT, but really any psychedelic or entheogenic experience, I'm happy to talk to you about and provide a non-dual perspective and reflection, and also an analysis of the energy of the whole thing and what's going on with you. Another quick update that I'm very close to finishing up my latest book, which I don't know if I've even mentioned that here on the podcast. Maybe I have, maybe I haven't, but my latest book is almost ready to go. I've got the proof copy here in my hands that showed up while we were gone visiting the Oregon coast over the past few days. The book is called A Sleep Story, An Unintentional Exploration of the Altered States of Being Awake. And it's something of a medical autobiography and memoir. It's kind of along the lines of Being Infinite, but not, because it's all about my sleep disorder and all the different therapies, all the different things I've tried, and all the different experiences related to having a chronic sleep disorder. And that'll be available very soon. So probably sometime within the next couple of weeks. I just got to go through the proof here, make sure everything is the way I want it to be, and then I hit publish, and it's out there. So new book is on the way, coming very shortly to an internet website that sells books near you. And I think that's all that I have for today. So yeah, let's go ahead and get into our conversation. Here's Jeremy Narby. I'm sure you know him as the author of The Cosmic Serpent, quite a popular book in psychedelic circles. And his latest book, once again, is Plant Teachers, Ayahuasca, Tobacco, and the Pursuit of Knowledge, co-authored with Rafael Chanchari Pizzuri. Here's my conversation with Jeremy Narby from just a couple of weeks ago. Enjoy. Thank you very much for sending me an advance copy of your book or your publisher. I've got that right here, and we want to talk about that today. And of course, I have Cosmic Serpent. Got this way back in, I think it was 98 that you released this. Is that correct?
Yep.
And, you know, I've got your book, Intelligence in Nature, and it's somewhere here, but I just recently moved in the last month and I haven't unpacked all my books. And so I was digging around for it. I was like, I can't find it. So it's still in a box somewhere. But primarily, you know, we want to talk about your new book today, but I'd like to hear, you know, just a little bit more about you, Jeremy, before we really get into the book and kind of what got you into anthropology. And I mean, you've already mentioned that you come from Canada, currently living in Switzerland. So I'd like to hear a little bit of your story and get to know a little bit about you before we talk about the content of the book.
Well, sure. I grew up in, I was born in Montreal, and my parents were immigrants from Egypt, Ireland, and England. They were already culturally mixed. And in Montreal in 1959, I lived in a French-speaking neighborhood. At home, we spoke in English, so it was already in a kind of a bilingual world. And so I grew up with that, speaking those two languages at the same time. I mean, you know, kindergarten was in both languages. My first 2 years of school was in French. The next years were in English. And then at the end of grade five, when I was 10, my parents moved to Switzerland. And we moved to another bilingual town, Fribourg. So it was French and German. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot smaller than Montreal and a lot more kind of medieval looking. And it was funny because people spoke French like in Montreal. They had white skin like in Montreal, but it was all also pretty different. I mean, the cars were smaller, the roads were smaller, the TV had less channels on it, and so on. And, you know, when you're 10 years old, that experience made an anthropologist of me, though I didn't know it at the time. It was like, wait a second, it's kind of the same, but it's really different. What's going on here? And, you know, people eat different food. They have different senses of humor. But then you're just a kid. You got to deal with it. And I kept on going to school in French and speaking English at home. So there was, you know, different languages, different cultures. And by the time I was 18, I was pretty confused about it. I was really interested in fact, in social justice, probably because my father was a businessman. So we were like, you know, well off or whatever, materially comfortable at the end of the 1970s. And I was interested in how come there are rich people, how come there are poor people. And my father said, look, go and study history at university if you don't know, you know, what to do. And that wasn't bad advice, but after studying history for a couple of years, this wasn't exactly what I was looking for. But a friend suggested I consider anthropology while at university, and I took a course in anthropology, and I thought, yes, this is it. This is what I'm interested in. And so I applied to Stanford to do an MA at Stanford, and somehow they accepted me. They were actually looking for people outside of anthropology. Like, so I was a historian. I had a BA. And so they wanted, at this point, like 1981, to bring in. So I got lucky. Went to Stanford, studied anthropology, and it was exactly what I'd been looking for, studying inequalities of race, class, and gender. And one professor said to me, look, you're interested in third world development, you know, why some people are rich, other people are poor. Go and look at a case of indigenous people. These are people who live in out-of-the-way places like the Amazon, the Arctic, the Australian desert. They occupy natural resources in a way that development experts, be they capitalist or communist, do not consider rational. So they're the Achilles heel of all development kind of theories. And so go and scratch at an Achilles heel and see what you get. And at that point, 1983, 84, the Peruvian government was financing with the World Bank and other international organizations the development of the Peruvian Amazon, which was penetrating indigenous territories, confiscating their lands, saying these people didn't use their resources rationally and didn't deserve the right to own their lands, and that what development was at this point was to take their lands away, give it to people with a market mentality so that they cut it down and turn it into cattle pastures. And this was the definition of development in the early 1980s, defended by experts, governments, and so on. So the idea was to do a kind of a politically engaged anthropology that went and looked at a case of this. And the whole idea, it was for theoretical reasons. I mean, I can say that as a lad who had grown up in the suburbs of Montreal, I was not that interested in indigenous people. You know, it had been ingrained into my 8-year-old Anglo brain that the Indians living on the reserve just down there couldn't be trusted and were alcoholics. I mean, that was a kind of, that's how it was in the 1960s. Unfortunately, I mean, so I ended up going to the Peruvian Amazon to study this. I ended up living with Ashaninka people as of 1984, right in the middle of the Peruvian Amazon, about 10 miles away from where a road, a penetration road, was being built into their territory, and lived with them to see how they used the rainforest to argue that they used it rationally, that is, without destroying it and productively, and therefore deserved the right to own their lands. So that was the theoretical thrust.
Yeah.
And at the same time, living, you know, the first nights that I slept in an Ashaninka village, I had to get rid of layers of prejudice, of racist prejudice that the young Montrealer had accumulated. I mean, were these redskins going to scalp me as I sleep? Kind of stupid idea going through your brain as you try to get to sleep the first night in one of these villages. And then you wake up the next morning and realize how ridiculous that is. And you, so you peel off the first onion skin of prejudice. But then there's like 200 of them. That's the interesting thing about, you know, doing field work and kind of going beyond your culture, going beyond your comfort zone, and trying to understand another point of view, which was the indigenous Amazonian point of view. We know what the World Bank's point of view is. What's yours? How do you understand the forest? How do you use it? What do you know about it? What stories do you tell about it? And so that was the research that I'd come to conduct and that I spent 2 years kind of carrying out.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, Jeremy, how did they receive you in showing up? Because I know it's a big issue in anthropology of, you know, someone coming in from outside and either being accepted or rejected by the indigenous culture. I myself did some field work at the Mescalero Apache Reservation in New Mexico. And
when was that?
That was in the late 90s. So between 94 and 2000, really, I was going out there. The majority of the time was in 97 and 98. And fortunately, I actually came from a background where I didn't have a lot of prejudices that my own grandfather, I mean, you can see I'm white, I'm perfectly white. My own grandfather, however, had grown up living with the Navajo, the Ojibwe, and Lakota, and had become fluent in all their languages. And so when I was a little kid, I thought we were Native American just because of my grandfather. So I didn't have my own prejudices so much to shed, though my sister, when I told her, you know, oh yeah, I'm going to go live with these Mescalero Apaches, she's like, well, do they wear clothes? Do they live in houses? And, you know, of course. So it's very different than going to the Amazon, but here you're going to a small community, very tight knit, 200 people. And here comes this white European Canadian. And so how was that?
So, right. The way in was actually not easy, but pretty easy to understand. The anthropologist who'd guided me towards the Peruvian Amazon as an interesting place to go and do field work, whose name is Richard Smith, who I met in Boston in the summer of '83, And the people I was doing some work with in Boston, a human rights center for indigenous people, the Anthropology Resource Center, they had met the national leader of Amazonian people's rights of Peru in Washington. And they gave me a letter to go and see, so the top guy at the head of the National Federation in Lima. So when I showed up in Lima, I went with my letter to him. He read it and said, okay, so you want to go and study Ashaninka people in the Peaches Valley where this project is happening? That's good. I'll write you a letter to the president of the regional organization. So then I traveled to the middle of the Peruvian Amazon and showed up at this guy's place with this letter and said, look, I'd really like to go and live in a community around here to show how you people use the rainforest so that it'll be easier for you to argue your case. Mm. And the guy in Lima says it's a good idea. And so here I am. And so he said, well, if the guy in Lima says, the president, Evaristo says, then I happen to have my brother-in-law who lives in an out-of-the-way place, because that's what you want, right? Out-of-the-way place. My brother-in-law is here. Tomorrow morning he's leaving. It's a 20-kilometer walk, but if you want, you can go and take a look if that would be good for you. So he talked to his brother-in-law. He was the chief of the valley, talked to the and the brother-in-law said, okay. So when I showed up in the community that I ended up spending 2 years in, the people who lived there and who had accompanied me said, look, the president of the region says that the president at the national level says that we need to receive this guy and answer his questions for 2 years because he wants to know how we work. And actually, that question of like, so here's a guy from a university. We're not sure what a university is, but we know that all these engineers come to talk about this place, mm-hmm. this place where there's that kind of knowledge. And this time, instead of telling us that we don't know anything, this guy actually wants us to show him what we know. Well, yes, that's interesting. That's interesting. The second thing is that I learned subsequently is that these people didn't trust white skin like yours and mine in any way whatsoever.
Yeah.
And in their view, white people were kind of vampires. And you had to be careful. Just like I was afraid that they might scalp me whilst I was sleeping, a lot of people in the village where I was were kind of afraid that I might be one of these Pishtako white vampires come to suck the life force out of indigenous women and children. I've actually written a piece on this, which is available on internet. It's called Confessions of a White Vampire. And it's all about, you know, so you live with people for 2-3 months, and then you understand that they think that you might actually be, you know, a bona fide vampire. And that's why you're white, because you live underground and because you occasionally come up through lakes and waterways. And then you go and you try to extract the life force out of indigenous people. It's actually a pretty good metaphor for the last 500 years of history. That was the problem, is that, no, I was not a bona fide vampire. But then you think about it, you say, wait a second, all of us Western, Northern kind of folks, including academics, not just the oil companies, we're all here to extract something.
Yeah.
I was there to extract data and return and write a doctorate and become a doctor in anthropology. In fact, I was saying, look, I'm doing this for your good because I'll argue in favor of how you use resources. But actually, at the end of the day, I was doing that so that I could get a PhD from Stanford and become a doctor. So it was unavoidably true that I was an extractor like all my other white predecessors, and that there was a kind of a vampire nature, perhaps not in me as a nice blue-eyed boy from the suburbs of Montreal and from Stanford University, but in the whole system of knowledge behind me and with me.
Yeah.
You know, that I thought it was normal to go and knowledge for knowledge's sake, extract knowledge and write a dissertation that would throw light on indigenous knowledge. But, you know, their view was like, look, this guy, he may be a nice guy and he may sort of say he's interested in our knowledge. And this is a kind of a new kind of white guy. But apart from that, it looks like he's an extractor like all his predecessors, too. Or what? It was a kind of a debate between them. It's like, it's interesting to have this guy with us. The president of the region asked us to have this guy with us. we're kind of interested in this guy, but he might also be kind of dangerous. So we got to keep him at a distance. I mean, people were always peppering me with questions, you know, about my boots, about my Swiss Army knife. They'd say, so how did you make this? And how did you make that? And, you know, I'd be saying, oh, man, I don't know how to, I actually don't know how to make a rubber boot with leather linings.
Yeah, I went to the store.
Yeah, that's right. They thought I was actually hiding my knowledge. But in fact, you know, I realized I was just an idiot in their eyes. I didn't know how to make the stuff that I owned that they found so fascinating. You know, so, and they didn't really believe that I didn't know how to how to make these things. So, you know, that encounter, it was an interesting encounter. You know, when it was over after 2 years, they threw a goodbye party for me because they are good at goodbye parties. And they made speeches and stuff. And then, so then it was up to me to make a speech. I said, look, it's been really good. Because what they'd said, well, we answered all your questions. We accompanied you. Sometimes you didn't see where you were walking in the forest. We had to look after you. But finally, you asked all your questions. And so here we are. Congratulations. And so there it is. So I said, well, look, thank you. Now, would it be useful to you in any way if I, would you, you know, could, if it, would it be useful if I stuck around a little bit longer? Oh, no, thank you. Why didn't you just do as you said, which is you said you'd come for 2 years and you'd ask questions and then you'd go back to your country to tell people how we work. Well, that would be useful to us. So, you know, no, don't stay. No more questions. Go back to your land and tell the people what you learned when you were with us here. That's what we would like. Thank you. Okay. That was 1986.
Just a couple things I'd like to comment on here, and then I want to hear more from you because this is really fascinating. But just sort of reflecting on sort of that something of the moral dilemma of the anthropologist, of that idea that when you're going and you are actually extracting something from a culture and it can serve them, but it's also serving you, that it's getting you your degree. And so there is this kind of inherent imbalance of power. And it's something that I never thought much about, you know, before I kind of got into a similar area. For me, it was through religious studies. But one of my professors was Charles Long, and he's African-American, and he was very interested in colonialism and the impact on indigenous cultures. And I just remember one lecture class where he said, well, you know, there's no other cultures in the world that send people around to study other people. And so he said, either there's something really smart happening here, or there's something really bizarre happening here, of this idea of, oh, we're going to study you, because then how does that knowledge get applied? Does it get applied for further domination, or does it get applied for empowerment of those local communities and kind of raising that issue? And so for myself, you know, that was an issue in doing my own field work, that, you know, everybody was asking me, so what are you going to do with this? Like, well, you know, how does this serve you? That was a big interest among the Mescaleros. And then also, well, then how is this also going to serve us, and trying to find that balance? Right. But it is an inherent power imbalance in that kind of situation. So I really love that they thought of you as a vampire. Not that, you know, I want to critique you in any way on that, but interesting.
Go right ahead.
I think it's very interesting to hear of what their perspective was. And something that I encountered at the Mescalero Reservation is that a lot of the people there spoke of anthropologists. They called them anthros. They referred to them in terms of their own categories of witchcraft. And that actually was very common. And they would say, oh, yeah, well, that anthro, like, shot a dart at me, and I, you know, I didn't feel comfortable for the next 3 days. And just interesting to how they would categorize their own experiences within their own worldview and framework. So I'm, you know, just kind of reflecting on that, you know, as you share this. So it sounds like you did not go specifically with the intent of really learning about the mind-altering substances, ayahuasca, tobacco. But of course, if you're studying how the indigenous people use the rainforest, how they cultivated their knowledge, how they use the plants and live within that environment, that became a topic for you.
Well, you know, that's right. And This was actually something that, so there I was, when you, so when you're finally living with these indigenous people, there you are, you've been in libraries and schools all your life, but then you say, okay, now I'm an anthropologist, I'm in the field. So now I've got to sort of get up and hang out with people, do what they're doing, and then ask questions and take notes or, you know, and such. So, okay, plants. And so what do you know about the rainforest? What do you know about plants? Oh, well, this plant does this, this plant does that, this plant. And they'd talk about plants like people. They'd say that they'd know all about all kinds of plants. You go into this rainforest with this, like, mind-boggling diversity. You look at the forest, there's no species that looks like another. It's like an impressionist painting or something. But they had names in their language for almost every species and attributed uses to, like, half of them. And so, you know, they'd say this plant accelerates the healing of wounds. This plant is a building material and so on. And so say, look, I've got a wound. You say this plant accelerates the healing of wounds. Let's see. Okay, so they press some of the juice of that plant into the wound. And lo and behold, I would see that it was true, that not only was their forest like incredibly diversified compared to the northern forest that I was familiar with, but you know, and they had names for plants and said things about them, but that the things that they said were actually, I could verify them with my body. So after a few times, I mean, there was a couple of these where, like, you know, they said, we have a plant that cures chronic backache. Well, you know, I had chronic backache. I played too much tennis. I'd been to these doctors and the cortisone injections and the heat treatments and nothing had worked. And these guys said, look, we got this plant. You drink half a cup of its boiled roots at the new moon. You'll be cold for 8 or 12 hours and you may see a few images. And then on the third day, you'll be healed. And I thought, look, this is pretty unlikely. If you know, they really did have a remedy for chronic backache, science would know about it. It couldn't be less effective than what the doctors had proposed so far. So, hey, you know, why not try it? And I tried this thing, and it worked just like they said it did. And on the third day, you know, my body turned to rubber. I was sweating cold bullets. I saw a few images. The next day, I was inapt for service. I couldn't even stand up straight. And on the third day, da-dam, the deep tension in my lower back had disappeared, and it actually never returned. Sanango. You know, and this was like, I didn't even believe it was going to work. So it was not psychosomatic, that's for sure. And it, so these people, you know, I verified several times with my body that they had a bona fide and surprising knowledge about plants. So then the question became, how do you guys know what you know about plants? And that's just it's an old Jesuit question. It's like, you know, you may not know what people are really saying, but you ask them about the origin of their knowledge. And it's a key question. I mean, it unlocks a lot of doors. It's a classic. And they would say, well, look, we have ayahuasqueros, tabaqueros. They take their ayahuasca, this hallucinogenic plant mixture, eat tobacco paste, and in their visions, they see the entities that animate all living forms and that are sources of information and that tell them about plant properties and other things. And, like, you know, the first time a guy told me this, I thought he was pulling my leg. Like, you learn about plant properties in your hallucinations. You take vegetal hallucinogens, and that's how you learn about plant properties? You know. But he wasn't laughing. And several people told me the same thing. So it was like, this is interesting. It's kind of funny. And I'd ask different people on different occasions, you know, oh, how do you know what you know about plants? And then one day, one guy said, look, Brother Jeremy, you want to know the answer to your question? You have to drink ayahuasca.
Yeah, have a drink.
It's the television of the forest. It'll show you images and you'll learn things. And if you like, I can show you sometime. And, you know, at that point, I'd actually taken LSD. I'd taken psilocybin mushrooms. I mean, let's call it recreationally, even though I found that they were interesting experiences beyond recreation. But still, you know, I'd read Castaneda. Because I'd read Castaneda, I knew that anthropologists dabbling with hallucinogens was not very good for the career. You know, I was there to investigate how Ashaninka people used the rainforest rationally. And they were saying, at the heart of our rational knowledge about the forest, or our verifiable knowledge about the forest, is this powerful hallucinogen and this experience. This very, you know, there's an irrational heart to our rational botanical knowledge. Mm-hmm. So it didn't help the argument that I wanted to make in my thesis. And in fact, I mean, so I had an ayahuasca experience that opened my eyes. It was way more real than I thought, you know, it could possibly be. It actually challenged my understanding of reality. It was much too powerful and much too consequential regarding reality to sort of deny as just a sort of a drug trip or something. But at the same time, it was something that I couldn't mention in my dissertation at that point. It actually contradicted my main premise. Maybe if I'd been more courageous, I would have dared to address it. But actually, I didn't. I kind of chickened out and chose to go for the doctorate, return to Stanford, wrote about the rational uses of the rainforest by Ashaninka people, and contrasted them to the World Bank vision, the missionaries' vision. It was called Visions of Land, Ashaninka People and Resource Development in the Peaches Valley, 1984 to 1986. And ayahuasca is like in two footnotes.
Did you talk to your advisors about it at all?
No, and, no. Certainly not.
So you just kept it to yourself?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I went to see my initial advisor. I actually changed advisors after this. I sort of came back. And he said, but you know, indigenous people like this are just condemned to be the proletariat of the future. This guy was a bona fide Marxist anthropologist. Indigenous people is a colonial category. Yeah. And these people who are just rural people will become proletariat in the future. And there is nothing particular to indigenous Amazonian people and their cultures.
So I changed
advisors.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's just to say that with the kind of climate there was that, I mean, you know, he was, that was the kind of most extreme, but it was like, this was no place where you could go and argue that, hey, they have this interesting hallucinogen called ayahuasca, and it allows you to see these enormous fluorescent serpents who can challenge your worldview. You know, that's what I didn't say at that point. And then, so I wrote the dissertation, and I think it's available. You can, you know, read it. It's I still stand by it. Everything that's in there, I think I'd stand by, but there's all the stuff that I didn't say, you know, and that was the problem. I got a doctorate, and I knew that I hadn't told the whole story.
Yeah.
You know, and the whole story was that at the heart of this knowledge that is actually real about the forest and the different plants and how to use them and so forth, that they themselves situated this kind of, I'll call it animistic or shamanistic or whatever you want to call it, relationship with other species as like people like us, and ayahuasca and tobacco were plants that were intermediates or like almost like telephones. Like if you want to speak with the community of beings that are the plants and animals around us, ayahuasca, tobacco, these other plant teachers are means of doing this. I mean, I found it difficult to argue that in the middle of the 1980s. As I say, I didn't have the courage to do it. You know, I played it safe. I did get the doctorate. But then for me, it was pretty obvious that the way to go, receiving the doctorate in 89, was to, well, become an activist. And so, in other words, stop studying people, start working for them, listening to them. What are your initiatives? As Amazonian people, I mean, the people wanted land rights. Okay, I'll go and argue for your land rights, raise funds for demarcating territories. As I started doing that in 1990, it's essentially the job I've been doing the last 30 years, is presenting Amazonian initiatives to foundations here in the name of rainforest protection. It's not just the idea. The fact is that if you want to protect the rainforest, the best way is to work with the indigenous people who live there and know how to use it respectfully. Indigenous territories that are legally controlled by indigenous people in the Amazon have a greater carbon density measured by satellite than natural protected areas, simply because indigenous people protect their territories when they own them better than national parks do. You know, so it really is true that listening to indigenous Amazonian people, taking their initiatives into consideration, backing their work to get their lands recognized, goes hand in hand with protecting the rainforest. And so it's been possible for the last 30 years to get ecological foundations, people interested in protecting the rainforest one way or another, to fund indigenous land titling. So, and where anthropology comes in useful, it's like, I wouldn't renege anthropology, because you learn to translate between worlds. You learn to go between mentalities. And so, you know, to make indigenous Amazonians understandable to European foundations and accountable to, and vice versa. And so the anthropologist, instead of being the guy who or person who studies and then writes books and becomes famous, it's more like you're at the service of a dialogue, you're a translator, and you allow different cultures and people to speak to each other so that they can collaborate and get something positive happening that wouldn't otherwise be happening. You know, so there is a way of, I think that there's, and where I would defend anthropology, and I think, you know, you don't have to be a sort of a white man with a beard and a pipe, even though I'm a white man with a beard and a pipe, to do anthropology. I mean, you know, you can be an Ashaninka, you can be an Apache, you can be Chinese. The idea that there is something beautiful in you leave your culture and you go into another culture and you try to understand it. And then you bring that back into your culture and you become an intercultural agent who understands differences between cultures and tries to create bridges of understanding, tell stories that people can understand on both sides. I mean, you know, these are skills. It's almost like dentistry is a skill or weaving is a skill. Well, translating between cultures is a skill, and anthropology, I think, kind of invented it. That's what anthropology in its purest form is. And it's something that those skills, something that the world needs. It's obviously, there's a power difference between if it's a sort of a rich white man who goes into sort of poorest and darkest Africa and writes about people, it's completely different than if a person from that place in Africa goes and studies Boston aristocrats in their golf courses, you know? It's just not the same power relationship, even though it's finally the same kind of work. And that's where there is inherently a kind of a power relationship when one culture is looking at another and trying to make it understandable to itself. That's where I think also that once you learn that skill, and it's like you go to school and you do your dissertation and you get trained, kind of like you would get trained in juggling. You know, you go to clown school and learn how to juggle, okay? Then you go and work in a circus. I mean, then there's the real world out there, which is this circus. And so once you've learned the skills, you go and try to make yourself useful. I've been trying to make juggling between indigenous Amazonians and European foundations for the last 30 years to get areas of rainforest demarcated and owned by indigenous people. You know, we've done, what is it? It's 14 million acres in 30 years, region by region. It's, 20% of the Peruvian Amazon or something, or... it's meaningful that if you concentrate on one area and you do this often enough, finally it makes a difference at the level. You don't change the world, but you can have an impact on a region if you do it long enough and seriously enough. Yeah. So that's where I would defend anthropology. It's good when you can apply it.
Yeah. And it certainly comes through in your books, like with the new book that's coming out, Plant Teachers, that you even list Rafael Chanchari Pizuri as co-author on the book and really kind of go back and forth between here's the scientific take on tobacco, here's the indigenous take on tobacco. And then also, of course, in your book, The Cosmic Serpent, I mean, this sounds like what if you felt confident enough in writing the dissertation the way that you really wanted to, and the information, the knowledge that was most interesting and fascinating to you, sounds like this is what then produced The Cosmic Serpent. So for you, what was the impetus to then put this together into book form and share that and decide, okay, well, this isn't necessarily your standard anthropology, but this is a really interesting perspective to share.
You're talking about Cosmic Serpent.
Yeah, The Cosmic Serpent. Okay. Yeah.
Well, actually, you know, that's a fairly easy one to answer, which is that, like, after writing that dissertation and getting the doctorate, was like, it felt like getting a driver's license. It's like, okay, here's your driver's license. And so now, you know, you can go and you can ask questions. And if anybody says, okay, so who are you? You say, oh, look, I'm a doctor in anthropology. Oh, okay, there we go. So it's a kind of a useful. The point is to then go and drive, go into the world and do things. So then I worked for this organization, started doing this fundraising. The work had impact. Territories started getting demarcated. I loved it. After spending like the first 30 years of my life in schools, from 30 to 35, I was like doing this fundraising, getting these results. I hardly read a book. I was really pleased to be away from theory and universities and libraries, and really happy to be immersed in making that knowledge useful. And still, at the same time, there was this thing where, like, by working with Amazonian people in this way of like fundraising and projects and accounts and land getting demarcated in a very real way, I saw that they were just serious customers. It's like what perhaps academic anthropologists weren't seeing at this point, as they asked them questions about mythology and kind of classical anthropology stuff, is that what I was seeing was that these guys knew what was good for them. They knew how to hold a budget. They knew how to go about doing it and to organize themselves. These guys were like serious customers. And when you would ask them about their knowledge about plants, which was increasingly recognized, everybody was talking in the early 1990s about the biodiversity of the Amazon and the knowledge of indigenous people about the rainforest and so on. But nobody was talking about the shamanic origin of part of this knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I could see that. It was like, okay, so wait a second. I'm seeing that these guys are serious customers. I haven't really read the books and the stuff that's been coming out now recently, but here we are like in Rio in 1992. Everybody's talking about indigenous people and their knowledge. Nobody's talking about the origin of this knowledge. Well, I knew why nobody was talking about it. I myself had not talked about it in my dissertation because it contradicted the basic principles of Western knowledge. That's why nobody was talking about it. So I thought, well, look, I mean, for anybody who's read the history of science, like Thomas Kuhn, you know, How Paradigms Advance, it's when you reach the limit of the paradigm and you can see this kind of contradiction. So here are these indigenous people with all this knowledge about plants in the rainforest. Our pharmaceutical industries steal this knowledge, but we can't even talk about its origin as these people themselves talk about it. I mean, what's going on? I thought we were open-minded, scientifically oriented, democratically inspired, cosmopolitan folks. So what's blocking us from sitting down and having a polite conversation with these indigenous Amazonians about the origin of their knowledge, just because it flies in the face of the tenets of our system of knowledge? That actually makes it even more interesting. Here are people living in the most biodiverse place on Earth. They say a good part of their knowledge that is now widely recognized by scientists comes from this realm, but we can't even have a conversation about it with them. Or else we risk getting disqualified. Well, that's really interesting. And it felt like if I didn't address this question, then who was going to address it? I was like an independent, non-university-based Canadian living in Switzerland, employed by an open-minded third world aid humanistic guy who wanted to help indigenous Amazonian people move forward. And, you know, I've, after like 4 or 5 years of just only doing practice of raising funds and working with these people, that I had the idea. It was the idea of an activist. It was like, we need to make the conversation about indigenous knowledge move forward by putting this on the table. And even if I come across as a crazy guy, that I actually take hallucinating shamans seriously, I actually consider that we're not just going to sort of not talk about this, but we're going to deal with it seriously and do an essay on it. Just one question. What does it mean when these people say that their knowledge comes from the hallucinations of their shamans? And so I asked my boss, you know, I said, I'd like to write a book about this, about the hallucinatory origin of the ecological knowledge of the indigenous people of the Western Amazon. And he said, sure, take your time. And this was like 1993. So, you know, I after not reading for like 4 full years, I like convoked the anthropological literature on shamanism that I had not read on Amazonian shamanism. And I devoured it, you know, after not reading for 4 years. I was just like in the starting blocks and ready to go and just like swallowed it in 6 months.
What were some of the sources you were looking at?
Well,
at
all
time?
The classical sources. It's just look at the bibliography of the Cosmic Serpent. I mean, you know, Reichel Dolmetoff and Levi Strauss and anybody who's written about Amazonian shamanism, and in particular in the Western Amazon, and Luis Eduardo Luna on and ayahuasca and tobacco. And, you know, there's lots of classical sources, Johannes Wilbert on tobacco, for example. But actually, after 6 months, I realized like, well, wait a second. I mean, these indigenous Amazonians have been, and so not just what the Ashaninka told me, but people living more than 1,000 miles away from the Ashaninka had told other anthropologists at other moments, basically the same thing. You know, how do we know what we know about plants? Well, we have these other plants, ayahuasca, tobacco, other plant teachers, and we ingest them, and then we have dialogues with their essences or personalities or the entities in these plants that are people like us, and that's how we learn about plant properties, and in fact, quite a few other things too.
Yeah.
So then, okay, all right, I got it. So what? But what does that mean? Yeah. What does that mean? And that was the thing. So then the rest of the book. So you know, read the book. The rest of the book is like, okay, well, what could that mean? And you know, you got to read the book. But that's how I got to writing that book. And I think that was your question.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was just, since you mentioned, yeah, well, look at the sources in the back. And one thing I was just quickly looking for was Michael Taussig. I've really enjoyed his books about shamanism and colonialism and the state memesis and alterity, I think is my favorite
book
of his.
That book really, it was part of the big ones during those 6 months. And it was like, when I read that book, I thought, oh man, yes. And, you know, I read that book to bits. I read it forwards, and then I actually read it backwards. And then I read it a third time by going through the index and just, you know, reading it kind of randomly according to the index. You know, just a wonderful, wonderful book.
Yeah, I first discovered that book in reference to what I told you before about my professor Charles Long, who was into colonialism and religion. And then I discovered Michael Taussig, and I was like, oh, this is exactly what he's talking about. I mean, this is just so, so fascinating. So I've really enjoyed him as an anthropologist.
Well, and then there was Michael Harner, of course, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And you've mentioned Carlos Castaneda, that he was always a sort of an interesting figure. You know, and my advisor, actually in graduate school, said that she had had a private conversation with Carlos Castaneda, and she said that she asked him, so, you know, be straight with me, Carlos. Is this stuff real? And he said, no, it's not real. I just made this stuff up. And, you know, I just used other sources. And anyway, that was supposed his confession to my advisor. I wasn't there, so, you know.
Well, you know, I never met Carlos Castaneda, unfortunately, or I don't know, I read his books. But the thing that I note, and it seems probable that he made quite a bit of stuff up and he had some experiences, but then made amalgams of different things. And,
yeah.
You know, people have written books about that and stuff. And but still, first of all, there's a lot of pretty reliable knowledge in there about Datura, about sorcery. You know, so that he was not telling stories that were very far off the mark. That's the first thing. I mean, not all the time. The second thing is that it's almost like the Western world took a trickster like Castaneda to get tricked back into taking shamanism seriously. And he knew how to tell stories. I mean, it's a very shamanic trick. It's like, so, you know, he took the Western storytelling anthropology format and told a story that he kind of made up and twisted and amalgamed and you know, did these sort of that kind of thing. So it's not at all kosher in academic terms.
No.
But it was extremely effective in terms of the culture. And, you know, the culture was so frigid and so far away that, you know, it took a trickster like Castaneda to kind of jumpstart the thing back into, to get it, you know, back to life and interested in it, interested in indigenous people, their knowledge, different ways of thinking about it. And you know, lots of people, including myself, found that this was an interesting subject, even if I took 8 years after my fieldwork experience to really get back into it. But, you know, I can't deny that Castaneda had, like many other people, had kind of fascinated me and said, like, there's probably something in this indigenous shamanism thing. And it doesn't seem to be just like superstition. It actually seems to be too powerful, you know, to handle with rationalism. It seems like, you know, it's almost the sorcery that he describes and some of the stuff that I saw with Ashaninka people is like, you know, this may be outside of our categories, but to say that it therefore doesn't exist, I think it's just a pretty bad mistake. You know, that's where I would defend Castaneda a bit, even if he was a complete trickster.
Yeah. Well, I certainly devoured all of his books myself. I found them fascinating, you know, and that became a question for me, like how much of this is accurate in terms of anthropological knowledge, and then what are his sources, and, you know, reading Raymond DeMille's kind of take.
Did you see that film, The Embrace of the Serpent?
I think so.
And the guy, he actually made a fiction between Schultes and Koch-Grünberg, and he invented a plant that is like half like ayahuasca and half isn't. And it's this Colombian, he made this kind of fantastic Amazonian historical kind of Tausig-like film. The fantastic fictional aspect to it, I mean, it was a fictional film, but it told a profound truth. It showed a profound historical truth of like the abuses of missionaries, the knowledge of indigenous people, the difficulty of including white men in the mix from an Amazonian point of view. You know, and sometimes it's not that it takes a lie to tell the truth, but it takes, you know, that fiction can actually have that transformational role sometimes in a way that nonfiction can't. And I say that as a guy who only does nonfiction. You know, I don't even read fiction because I don't have time. You know, I'm just a nonfiction guy, so... But there are times when fiction does a better job at this stuff.
Yeah. Well, I attempt to do that myself, that I write both fiction and nonfiction. And I like using the fiction to communicate a lot of the same ideas that I'm writing about in my nonfiction work. Something that just popped into my head since you mentioned a movie. I'm curious if you've seen the film Black Robe about Jesuit missionaries in French Canada.
No, I'd like to see that.
It's a really interesting film because, you know, there's these Jesuit missionaries and they're with, I believe there's some Huron people, and the missionary goes to you know, the son of the chief or whatever, and says, "Tell me something about your dad that I don't know," or something like that. So mm-hmm. he whispers something to him, and then he writes it down. I might be mixing it all up, but anyway, it's supposed to be that something that the guy shouldn't know, and then he reads it back to this other character. It's like, how did you know that? It's like, well, I read the words here. And the priest is very proud of him. So he's like, yeah, I just showed these savages that, you know, our great technology of writing. And then the very next mm-hmm. scene is the elders sitting together, and they're speaking in their own language, and they're talking, they're saying, "So what do you think? Is he a demon?" He's like, "Yeah, he's definitely a demon. Like, with that thing that he did, that was weird. Yeah, that was weird. And he doesn't sleep with women. Is that true?" "Yep." "Okay, he's definitely a demon. What should we do?"
"Don't trust that guy."
I said, "Well, I think we should kill him." And I love the juxtaposition in that film. And it does that all the way throughout the film, of sort of showing the missionary and what his perspective is, and then what the indigenous perspective is of his actions, and kind of their own reverse anthropology of trying to understand, like, well, who is this weird guy who dresses in the weird clothes and doesn't sleep with women and has this weird magic?
Yeah. Reverse anthropology is very interesting.
Yeah.
And needs to be encouraged.
Yeah.
More of that. Is that a recent film, by the way?
No, it's from quite some time ago. It was probably made back in the 90s.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, Black Robe. It's a good movie. I definitely recommend it.
Right.
So let's talk about tobacco.
Okay.
And kind of to get us into tobacco, I'll share something that I've been seeing on my Facebook feed the other day. Is like somebody was posting Mesoamerican stone carvings, and people saying, "Oh, well, anthropologists say that this is a tobacco offering, but this is definitely DMT, because look at all the weird stuff that's coming out of this guy's head. And, so this got to be DMT. There's no way this could be tobacco." But, you know, of course, as you write about in your book, and here, you know, we're going to be talking about your newest book, Plant Teachers, Ayahuasca, Tobacco, and the Pursuit of Knowledge, that the tobacco that we're talking about in indigenous communities, we're not talking about modern cigarettes. We're talking about mm-hmm. different kinds of tobacco that play a different role, as you've been describing, in the production of knowledge. So, I've had a lot of ayahuasca here on the show, so I thought it'd really be interesting to talk a little bit more in detail, really, about tobacco and what role it plays, and often in conjunction with ayahuasca and other visionary medicines, but that it's considered a supreme plant teacher in and of itself. So that will be your gateway to tell us what you like about tobacco and how it features in the book.
Most Westerners, I mean, both of my parents used to smoke. My father gave up smoking 60 cigarettes a day in the 60s, and then he became a zealous anti-smoker. You know, my mother used to kind of smoke menthol cigarettes in hiding. And I grew up thinking that cigarettes were bad and just a waste of time and, you know, just not good, not interesting. And that's all there was to it. I didn't really think much more than that about tobacco. And then I went to Peru to do the research I was describing with Ashaninka people, looking into what they knew about the forest and stuff. And they would talk about tobacco. I mean, the word for shaman in their language, or for doctor, was sheri piari. Sheri means tobacco, and piari means doctor, or person who knows. The tobacco doctor, you know. And so, the tobacco doctor. Yeah, and so then actually my main consultant, who was a 45-year-old man, he was actually a tobacco shaman, and he was a pretty inspiring guy, and he would talk a lot about tobacco, and tobacco as, well, like as this being, as this friend, as this teacher, as this entity that showed him things, that protected him, that allowed him to heal. And these were not just stories, and so I was actually figured that one of the anthropological techniques was just to tell people, would you tell me the story of your life? Mm. And you bring the tape recorder over and you know, you get them to, and if they're good storytellers, they're off. Where were you born? When was it? Then what happened? And off you go. And his uncle, he was an orphan. He lived with his uncle. His uncle was a tabaquero or tobacco shaman. And he learned about tobacco when he was 8. And tobacco was part of his story. And it's central in Shaninka culture, central in their knowledge. These people, like, they make tobacco paste and they smoke it. And it's really referred to very in a central fashion as being at the origin of their knowledge, just like ayahuasca is. You know, tobacco, tobacco, tobacco. We're a long way from chain-smoking cigarettes in Montreal. And actually, this stuff was, like, so powerful. It was a lot more powerful. It was almost, like, hallucinogenic powerful. You'd draw, and I never really liked tobacco, but this stuff was like, whoa. And especially tobacco paste. I mean, smoking it, I found impossible. I can smoke tobacco. I don't like smoking tobacco. I hardly ever smoke tobacco. Certainly not the strong stuff. I mean, you know, it's not plant really. But with Ashaninka tobacco paste, it's like jam, and you put a stick into it, and then you rub it through your lips and stuff. This stuff is like almost hallucinogenic. It gets you takes you into these different spaces. So, tobacco, tobacco, and tobacco was never. I mean, ayahuasca was at least something. You know, I grew up in Switzerland. LSD is an indigenous molecule in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. It's a hallucinogen. Ayahuasca is a hallucinogen. I mean, ayahuasca was at least understandable to me as a hallucinogen like LSD. In fact, my experience was that it was more powerful than LSD. It took me into places and hallucinogenic visions that LSD didn't. It was a lot more hallucinogenic than LSD was, I found. But this tobacco thing was this very strong. There was no denying that there was something there. And I mean, I had this experience that I describe in the book Plant Teachers, where my main informant, who's 45, took me to meet his tobacco shaman teacher. And the old man was way up in the hills. He was at least 80 years old. He didn't even know how old he was. He was that old at this point. I mean, Ashaninka people weren't counting years when he was born, early 20th century. And this guy was sitting on his mat, eating his tobacco paste and laughing. He actually asked me like 20 times in a row if I was his father-in-law. He asked me this in Ashaninka. I don't think the old boy's playing with me. I mean, I'm not even a third his age. I kind of played along with him. My friend told me later that during that day that what he was saying was, "Can I sleep with your daughters?" But you know, so the joke was on me.
Yeah.
But anyway, to put an end to this, "Are you my father-in-law?" thing, I said, "Hey, you know, could I try your tobacco paste?" And he said, "Sure, here." So I tried some of this stuff, and then I kind of sat to the side and let the two guys get on with their business. And after like 10, 15 minutes, I felt like I was turning into a feline. I felt that I had like whiskers. I had a taste of blood in my mouth. My teeth seemed sharp and long. I started looking at the chickens that were clucking around and decided not to attack them, you know? And it was like, whoa. I even thought like, ooh, you know, the tobacco paste is strong when the anthropologist starts attacking the chickens, you know?
Yeah.
This is, I don't believe in jaguar transformation. This is like way off the charts in terms of, you know, but I had this bodily experience of empathy with the feline that was intense, warm. There was an aggression there, you know, towards like chickens. I felt like kind of bloodthirsty and happy about it, even though I was a vegetarian at this point. I mean, you know, this was an intense kind of transformational mental body kind of experience. From then on, I had a lot of respect for tobacco. I had no desire to go back there. Actually, that experience was so powerful that it's like it stayed with me to this day. It's like something I kind of have this feeling deep down that I know what it's like to feel like a cat, and I can convoke that. I mean, I don't talk about it that much, but you know, it's something that once you've actually lived it with your body, it's not just reading about it. It's something that you know what it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
So that was like an experience that got me to think, okay, well, look, the tobacco, just like ayahuasca, these people are serious customers. They say these plants are power plants, they're teacher plants. You work with them, they're master plants. You never master them, but you can work with them. You can use them as allies, and it takes know-how. It's these are not easy things, and you got to be careful when you work with these plants. But if you know how to do it, you can get knowledge from them. That was the Ashaninka point of view. It's true. You know, when I came back to either my university in California or then back to Europe where I lived in the late 80s, start talking about ayahuasca, people thought that was pretty weird. They'd never heard of it at that point. It was like, you know, maybe this guy's spent too long in the jungle or something. You say, yes, there is this jungle juice you drink and you hallucinate fluorescent serpents, and then they tell you that you are just a tiny human being. And then, and you know, people's eyes would glaze over, and sort of it was kind of impolite conversation at this point. So then, okay, let's not talk about ayahuasca. Tobacco. You guys smoke cigarettes. Man, tobacco comes from the Amazon. Let me tell you about the Ashaninka's perspective on tobacco. Well, and then I'd launch into it. And once again, you know, people would say, this guy, I mean, frankly, that jungle is probably not very good for people. So I found that was interesting. So here's a plant. It actually comes from the Amazon. The white people have taken it away from indigenous people and weakened it, and then laced it with chemicals, and then turned it into this kind of addiction thing for commerce that is fatal. But the original plant has a lot more nicotine in it, and there's like no known physiology of cancer among indigenous tobacco shamans. In fact, it's considered the number one medicinal plant. People use it as a painkiller. They use it as poultices. As soon as anybody's ill, you blow tobacco smoke on them. It's like the number one therapeutic treatment, all illnesses put together. So, well, that's interesting. You know, we've turned it into a product of, it's like it causes the most non-necessary deaths in the world every year. It's the biggest source of, you know, non-necessary death. But in the Amazon, where it comes from, where people have worked for it for a long time, where the plant hasn't been transformed, where it's not laced with chemicals, it's right at the heart of their medicine. Well, I'll be dogged. You know, so that's just intrinsically interesting. Let's look at it. I started looking at it a little bit in The Cosmic Serpent 25 years ago. And then this book it was okay. I thought I advanced the question of tobacco a little bit in that book,
mm-hmm.
Even though it was just a popularizing book. I mean, you know, it never did claim to be doing fundamental research, but it at least highlighted research that had been done and put questions on the table in a simple kind of non-academic way. Hey, look at this. And so I think, yeah, The Cosmic Serpent, more than before being an ayahuasca book, it was a tobacco book, but you know, it was read as an ayahuasca book. I actually thought that the book was more about tobacco than ayahuasca. But, and you know, at that point, obviously people, when the book came out in French in 1995, hardly anybody had heard of ayahuasca. Everybody had heard of tobacco. But the book ended up very quickly being perceived as an ayahuasca book, and no one ever really talked about the tobacco in there. Okay,
yeah.
Fair enough. I mean, you know, you can't oblige people to read your book in a certain way. That's not the point anyway. But more than 20 years later, I thought, okay, well, the time has come to sort of look into tobacco again. And the time has come also to look at ayahuasca 20, 25 years later. What has science learned about it? What do indigenous people continue to say about it? What's their view of all these Westerners who've suddenly been coming and start working, because these are both very Amazonian plants, plants that come from there and that were discovered by the people, the indigenous people there, and at the heart of their systems of knowledge and cosmologies and so on. And then suddenly, okay, all these gringos are coming and taking ayahuasca and taking it away and using it and so forth. Okay, so what's your view? And about tobacco, let's just reconsider. We're not having big intellectual conversations about I don't know what. Well, let's just talk about two plants that are psychoactive and that interest a certain number of people. And actually, science has been studying tobacco a lot longer than it's been studying nicotine. And when you try to line up, like we do in that book, you look at, so what do indigenous Amazonians say about tobacco? And then you look at what science says about tobacco. Actually, there's been like 200 years of research on tobacco. Ayahuasca science is barely 20 years old. You know, so actually it's a lot less advanced, but still, what the book attempts to do is like put on the table a synthesis of these two forms of knowledge about these two plants, and you can compare what the indigenous expert says about tobacco, what scientists are saying about tobacco now, and you know, about nicotine and about how it works in the body, and it's actually far from clear just how nicotine impacts on our minds. It's a lot more clear on how it impacts on the body. And then there's ayahuasca, which I think the understanding of exactly how ayahuasca works in our brains, in our bodies, this too is something that's only just starting to come out. And so it's interesting to look at the indigenous version and then the scientific version on both of these plants. And I think it gives by providing this in a kind of a readable form, it gives the full kind of 180 degrees gamut on the question. And then people, you know, they can decide what they think is, you know, I think that actually combining both is the richest way to go, is that both perspectives have validity. And when combined, it makes even more sense. So, you know, the book ends up arguing that the bicognitivism, two ways of knowing, combined in a way where you can go back and forth, just like bilingualism, you know, speaking two languages and being able to go back and forth, you have more concepts and more words if you can speak another language and not just English. Yeah. You know, there are words in French that don't exist in English and vice versa. But if you speak both languages, hey, you have these concepts and you can use them to think and to make sense of the world. And I think it's like that with indigenous knowledge and science. And I think the book shows that in a very concrete way, because it's grounded not in a discussion of concepts, but in a discussion about these two powerful plants that Amazonians consider to be teachers and that scientists consider to be psychoactive and filled with psychoactive substances. But actually, there's not a contradiction between being a plant that is filled with psychoactive substances and being a plant that can actually teach things to humans. You know, so that's essentially what the book doesn't really argue it. I think it shows it. That's what the book does.
Yeah, it really demonstrates that, and kind of putting these two perspectives side by side throughout the book. And sort of speaking of this complementarity of the two different sides, is that something that also comes out in the indigenous description of both ayahuasca and tobacco, where they're talking about how, for example, in the ayahuasca, you raise the question of, well, how is it, you know, sometimes Westerners, they drink ayahuasca and they kind of come up with a lot of crazy ideas about themselves, but you say that ayahuasca won't lie to you. And then the indigenous perspective comes back as, well, it can also show you that you're lying to yourself. And that's a real lie that you're telling yourself. And then also with the tobacco, that it has sort of these two different personalities, that it can lead you towards more beneficent behavior or perhaps more malevolent behavior, that it has its own motivations. So maybe you could tell us a little bit more about sort of these different views within the indigenous perspective of how people might relate to these different plant teachers, or how the plant teachers might relate to the people. It might be the more accurate way to put it.
Well, you know, I think it's also important to be clear what one is speaking. I think that the scientific perspective or a rational, you know, academic perspective has been based, at least, you know, until very recently, on the idea that we don't personify nature, we objectify it. That's what actually science is. It's an objectification of nature. And so we treat plants and animals like bags of substances, if they're plants. I mean, and we look at them as physico-chemical entities, and that actually projecting mind onto them or humans have this has been difficult and it's always contentious, and especially with plants. With animals, things have been moving in the last 20, 30, 40 years. And, you know, we're very careful not to personify, because the whole method of science is not to personify, it is to objectify. Okay, we got it, we understand. The indigenous perspective is actually a personification, and it says you can also know plants and animals by considering that there's someone home. There's a person inside. There are people like us. So we don't look the same. Our eyes mislead us. But inside that plant, inside that tree, there's a person like us. We're the same family. And that's what animism is. That's the definition of animism. So this is an animist way of looking at nature, at plants and animals. And actually, it has a validity. That was the thing that when I first met the Ashaninka people, they would talk about the plants in the forest like they were people, like they were intelligent, like they were beings with their own agendas, with their own points of view. That's what being a person is. It is having a point of view. And that what you can do, and that's what shamanism is, or taking ayahuasca, tobacco, and so on, is opening your mind to an empathy, to thinking in terms of the point of view of the plant, of the other species. So having empathy so that you consider that this living being is not that different from you. In fact, it's the same family. It's like we're all one terrestrial family. And we all are very similar. We all want to survive and strive and live and reproduce, and we just look a little bit different. But inside that blade of grass, there's a person. Well, that is the indigenous shamanic animist point of view. It has its validity up to a certain point. The objective view also has its validity. I think that objective science, by discovering molecules, by discovering actually, yes, okay. So a plant is also a bag of substances. It is full of molecules, but actually I'm a bag of substances. I'm a flesh bag. But I'm not just a flesh bag. I'm both an object or a bag of flesh, and, you know, stick a knife and it bleeds, it gushes out. I mean, you know, we can see it, bag of blood, but I'm also a living being, a sentient being. I learn, I remember, I communicate, I decide. Well, actually, so does a plant. Learns, remembers, communicates, decides, perceives. So yes, a plant is a bag of substances, but a plant is also a sentient being. And the objective view, the view that limits itself to objectifying plants and animals, cannot really consider the sentient being part of the plant. Actually, the shamanic view that considers the plant as a sentient being has a hard time getting into the molecules, because that's what the scientific technology has allowed to discover. So actually, the two are perfectly complementary in that sense. And that's where the book we did is interesting. It's actually fairly easy to bring these apparently quite different approaches to knowing together, and just showing how they line up very well and open up all kinds of mutual questions for each other. When you ask, what do these plant teachers have in mind? Well, we've stepped off the scientific rational turf. We've stepped on to the animist turf. I like to make clear which turf we're on, if only because I don't really speak for animism and shamanism. I give the microphone to animists and shamans. I think their points of view are interesting, but I'm still pretty firmly in the Western world. I mean, I'm a Westerner raised in universities. I take my molecules seriously, but I also take indigenous knowledge seriously, and I prefer to let them speak about, you know, their point of view on the matter. How would they see this? I've had kind of experiences where the plant, the ayahuasca or what have you, has taught me things. I've understood things. I've come to a fuller understanding of situations, of chapters to write, of whatever it is during an ayahuasca session. But, you know, I've always thought that the point was to use that knowledge and to show it. And so I never really talked that much about learning from plants. I rather let the Amazonians talk about that part, even though I've had that experience a little bit. That's what I could say initially about your question. But that, yes, there is certainly a lot to learn if one is like a Westerner and who tends to be interested in verifiable knowledge, to learn to listen to this indigenous approach, which has empathy with other species and which personifies them. It considers them like persons. In other words, considers them as beings that have a point of view.
Yeah, and I think it comes through very beautifully in the book. And I think it's a great way for people to, you know, get a vicarious experience of what that view is. That within the book, I want to say the name correctly, Raphael, you let him communicate his own view. And you're not there as the anthropologist to say it's either right or wrong, but you're saying, well, here's what we've learned scientifically about these plants, and here's what Raphael has to say about it. Here's the position that these plants hold within his culture and the personality of the plants and how they're understood and how they're interacted with.
Thank you. It's true, but I would add to that my point of view, and in the dialogue with Raphael, it's not only just giving the mic to the guy and letting him speak so that finally indigenous knowledge gets heard a little bit. It's also actually treating him like an equal. Let's get some fencing going. In other words, okay, you know, so that sometimes I actually challenge him. So wait a second, you're saying the mother of the plant is a man? You know, tell me a little bit more about that. You know, so in other words, it's not that I play the stupid rationalist, but I think there's a role for the stupid rationalist. Say, wait a second. You know, this shamanic approach is interesting, but it's not easy for me to understand, for other people with another point of view, not easy for scientists to understand. Could we go a bit more slow here, and could you tell us a little bit more precisely what your view is? In other words, I think that a true dialogue is not too respectful. It has to be very respectful, but, you know, that there should be that element of like, I'm not sure I understand. And it's not to judge the other guy, but just so that, you know, I think that's what putting science and indigenous knowledge on equal footing is. It's not like taking science off the pedestal and then putting indigenous knowledge back on the pedestal. It's like it's stepping down from the pedestal with science. Then we're on equal footing and let's have a conversation. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, hey, I don't understand what you're saying. Could you clarify? And having that kind of, you know, true dialogue sometimes you got to agree to disagree. Sometimes the concepts don't translate. There are times I call these kind of frictions. There are times when it's difficult to find a bridge between like what Raphael is saying about the plant and what science is going to be saying. And maybe science isn't even talking about that part yet. So, you know, there are bits where there is not really a translation. And those bits are interesting too. If you're going to understand how to go back and forth between two languages, one important part is learning where there is no correspondence of concepts. I mean, sometimes there just are not words in English for words that exist in another language, and vice versa. And it doesn't mean that one language is better than another. It just means that they're different, that they have different strengths, and that often you can translate, but often translations are also betrayals, as they say. And sometimes there's just like an absent corresponding concept. And, you know, we're only just at the beginning of really getting dialogues going between scientists and indigenous people who know things. We tried to just give an exemplar. Look, it's fairly easy to sit down and have a dialogue. It's not always easy to find common ground all over the place and sometimes there are these frictions, but you know, that doesn't matter.
Yeah. And it's a reflection of kind of where anthropology is today versus where it was classically. Was, you know, of course, the anthropologist comes in and, well, we've got our theories of social structures and family dynamics, and here are all our categories that we're going to analyze this culture and see how they fit within our categories, and then we've understood them and yay. But it wasn't the dialogue that you're discussing here, where we actually do get to have the opportunity to question back and forth, that we can participate in each other's worlds and learn from each other. And so it's more of an interactive form of anthropology, but is not just giving up on the Western scientific rationalist perspective, but bringing that more into dialogue and interaction with the indigenous perspective. So it's a healthier form of interaction.
Yeah, but and see, what's also interesting, and I think it emerges in the book, is that Rafael Chanchari, who is a Shawi expert from the Shawi people in the Peruvian Amazon, he's completely open to science. He sees no contradiction between the mother of tobacco and nicotine. It's seamless in his view. You know, when I say, oh, so, you know, well, he says, yes, well, clearly we need nicotine and neurons to perceive the mother of tobacco. Full stop. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Easy enough. But the ones who have more difficulty taking the other's form of knowledge seriously is us Westerners. We've been raised on the idea that ours is the only valid way of knowing. So then we're surprised when we see that indigenous people have knowledge that lines up next to ours and is even more advanced than it. But the converse isn't true. Amazonians think it's just obvious that we have knowledge that they don't, and that it's interesting, and it's interesting to see how they correspond or don't. You know, so actually they're more open in terms of other systems of knowledge than most Westerners are, indeed than most university-trained people are. And that too is interesting.
Yeah. Well, you've been very generous with your time, and I know it's getting late on your end. I do have just kind of one other topic that I'd like to bring up with you, and then I'll let you go for tonight. And this has to do with sort of the transmission of cultural knowledge. And I'll use an example from my own field work to kind of introduce this, where it's about the plants and about the landforms and the ecology and all of that, that traditionally in Mescalero Apache culture, that women were considered to be the repositories of cultural knowledge. And so when girls reach puberty, they go through a very elaborate ceremony, just called the girls' initiation ceremony, or in English, it's the big teepee. It's the kuwatsu in Apache. And over the course of four nights, these male singers sing these sets of songs for the girls that categorize. All the songs are about different systems of knowledge, like here are all the landforms, here are all the birds, here are all the trees, here are all the flowers, and kind of communicating this to all the girls. But it's all sung in Apache, and now very few young girls actually know Apache, almost zero at this point. So the cultural system is still being practiced, but the knowledge is not actually effectively being passed down because of this language barrier. So how do you see this indigenous knowledge being passed on currently within the cultures that you have studied with, and also how might that be impacted by the outside interest in ayahuasca and ayahuasca tourism, and how might that be disrupting cultures or altering their own indigenous knowledge systems? It's kind of a big question as a last one, but whatever you
but
might
I,
like
I
to
got,
say on that.
I got a fairly compressed answer.
Okay.
Which is that when I spent the early 1990s working with indigenous Amazonian people from Peru and their organizations to demarcate their territories. After we'd done that for 3-4 years, they said, okay, once we have got people to respect our territories, the next thing we need is to get people to respect our cultures. And what's going on now is that our children are being taught to read and write in only in Spanish and only in Western knowledge. So what we need after getting recognition for our territories is recognition for our systems of knowledge. We need bilingual intercultural education for our children in primary schools in the villages of the Peruvian Amazon. And we need funds for this. And starting 26 years ago, I actually found some funds in a foundation in Liechtenstein, and they've been funding the program for bilingual and intercultural education of IDESIP, which is the Federation of Indigenous Organizations of the Peruvian Amazon. They've been training hundreds of bilingual, intercultural, indigenous teachers in more than 10 languages, producing teaching materials. And these teachers are now teaching in over 500 schools across the area to children in their mother tongue and in their system of knowledge, which also means going into the forest and so on, as well as in Spanish and science. So that these people are very advanced in combining different systems of knowledge and in having this for the education of their children. So it's actually, one can, in a very practical way, encourage the transmission of indigenous ecological knowledge by working with these school systems and funding them and helping set them up. So that's, and it's ongoing. So, you know, that's, and that's how the indigenous people themselves said one needs to go about it. That's how they have been going about it. And that's what one can do if one wants to help them do this. So that's pretty easy. I actually forgot the second part of your question. I'm sorry.
About how ayahuasca tourism might be disrupting the process of indigenous knowledge.
Contrary to what one might think, because a lot of people, you know, say bad things about ayahuasca tourism and stuff, and there are obviously things that one can criticize, but taken from a bit more distance, this is like the first time in 500 years that outsiders have come and said, we're interested in what you know. Mm-hmm. We're ready to pay you for your knowledge. Okay, paying people, it creates inequalities, and this has been criticized and so on, but still, outsiders being interested in indigenous knowledge and taking it seriously and even ready to swallow the purge themselves, this is something new and something that puts a value on indigenous knowledge and that also gets, I mean, you know, indigenous Amazonian people have integrated a lot of kind of scorn that Westerners poured on them. You know, you don't have the right religion, you don't have technology, you don't have scientific knowledge, you know nothing, you're just a bunch of savages. And so, you know, they actually sometimes integrated this. So when these foreigners come and say, no, we're actually interested in your knowledge about plants, we'd like you to teach us, we'd like you to heal us, this has actually got a whole generation of young indigenous people and non-indigenous Amazonian people interested in their plants, in their knowledge, in their traditions. You know, it's taken Western interest in ecology to get Peruvians in Lima interested in Peruvian ecology. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's also kind of how the world works, unfortunately. But look, if it's going to take kind of like Western imperialism or Western kind of things to jump start or reverse the effects of colonialism and get Peruvians to care about their country, get indigenous people to have confidence in their own knowledge again, you know, I think this is a good thing. It's kind of like that example of Castaneda we were talking about. It was like the situation was so bad, it took like jump starting it back to life that way. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, ayahuasca tourism may not be that glorious, may be filled with contradictions, but still the way it fits into the broader picture, it's not only all bad. And there has certainly been a sort of message that in young indigenous people have been getting, like, this is actually a way to earn a living. These Westerners come, they're interested in it. A long time ago, they used to say, not so long ago, they used to say it was the devil's stuff. You know, the missionaries were forever telling us, stay away from these plants. here they are, they're coming by hundreds or thousands, and they want to pay us for it, and they're interested in it. Well, you know, it's it opens up a space of opportunity and dialogue that may be full of sort of awkwardness and contradictions and even danger, but it's also full of opportunities and openings and new stuff happening. So, you know, I would take a kind of a more nuanced view on it. And that's how indigenous people like my co-author Rafael Chancheri also talked about it. You know, the gringos are welcome to come, but they just have to, you know, understand a bit better what they're doing. And that's also why we wrote the book.
Yeah.
You know, so that you can, before going down there, you can read about it and sort of, you know, get a better understanding of things.
Yeah. Well, great. Thank you so much for your time today, Jeremy. I really enjoyed our conversation.
It was a real pleasure.